Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you can be with us today. Today we're talking about immigration. We're not focusing on the hot-button political issue today. We want to explore the role of immigration in our collective history, particularly as Marylanders. It's often said that we are a nation of immigrants. Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty have become symbols of that. But it turns out Baltimore had no small role to play in America's immigrant history. In the years between the Civil War and World War I, giant steamships full of passengers frequently landed in Baltimore. Some travelers hopped right on to a train for points west, but many chose to stay. At one time, one in four Baltimoreans spoke German. There were also neighborhoods of Irish, Italian, Lithuanian, Polish, and Czech immigrants. In recent decades, immigrants from many countries in Asia and Central and South America have arrived. Of course, many Africans came to Maryland as slaves, and in the 20th century, internal migrations reshaped America. The Great Migration of African Americans from the South to northern states, and during and after World War II, a wave of white workers from Appalachia and the South to the North. There are museums that tell the story of some of the ethnic communities and how they fared when they arrived in Maryland. The Jewish Museum of Maryland, the Irish Railroad Workers Museum, Lithuanian Hall. But nowhere is there a museum that embraces all of the immigrants who first set foot in this country in Baltimore. Until now. A week from Sunday, on May 8th, the Baltimore Immigration Museum will open its doors for the first time. It will be housed in a former boarding house for newly arrived immigrants in Locust Point, known as Immigrant House. And here to tell us about the museum and the history of immigrants in Baltimore are Brigitte and Nick Fessenden, who spearheaded the project. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us is Joanne Best. She's a member of the Locust Point Community Church, which successor to the church, or at least located in the same building as the church that ran the boarding house during the heyday of immigration to Baltimore. Very glad you could be with us, Joanne.
Thank you, Sheila.
Nick, why do you think so few people know what an important port Baltimore was for immigration?
Well, it just has not been publicized very much, and there really weren't any markers that were visible or known. Of course, New York is very famous for having Ellis Island, and that's something that people visit, and you have the Statue of Liberty. For Baltimore,
of course, Ellis Island has the buildings that immigrants
the buildings are still there,
through, yeah.
The original buildings. And but for Baltimore, the piers are gone where the ships came in. So the immigrant house is really the best remaining marker for Baltimore's immigration history.
Yeah, Brigitte, tell us about the immigrant house. It was built in 1904.
Yes.
Who built it and how was it used?
Well, the official builder is the church. Was the church,
The church at that time was called.
I say it in German, the Deutsche Evangelische Vereinigte Christuskirche.
So that was the German Evangelical
United Evangelical Church. They had help from other churches, from other organizations. And there is a rumor, we're not sure if it's how, much the German government may or may not have helped with building this house.
Oh, that's a rumor.
It's another rumor, but there's no hard documentation.
I have not been inside it. From the outside, it seems to be in tremendous shape, the building. Tell me how it was used.
It was used as Nick mentioned, or you already, as a boarding house for newly arrived immigrants who did not have any contacts or jobs or friends or relatives waiting for them to take them in. So they would stay in the immigrant house for as little as 3 days, maybe as long as 3 months. And maybe Joanne can talk a little bit more about that. There's a guest book still in the house from that time.
Yeah, Joanne, tell us more.
Well, it opened in 1904, and we used to have a lot of records. We had all the original records, and unfortunately, they were loaned to the University of Baltimore back in the 1960s, and we did not get them back.
Are they still there, or are they lost?
We have looked everywhere. Our board, Baltimore Immigration Memorial, each of us has taken a turn at some library looking and searching to see if we can find them again, but they seem to be lost. And we do have some records. We have the guest book, which is actually very comical. People were very relieved once they were here, and sometimes they would stay at the house longer than others. But
so this is a guest book where people signed in as they arrived?
As they and stayed in the boarding house.
And made some kind of a comment about what?
Oh, poems, drawings, beautiful drawings of their ship, poems of their experience. And they were just grateful to be here. And we have beautiful letters from people. It almost reads like a history book, where they left the immigrant house and went on to work in New York City and then out west to be a part of the gold rush. And they would write the minister back at the boarding house for different references. And so he did. So letters like that.
How interesting. Nick, what proportion of people who, of immigrants who arrived by ship in Baltimore in the 19th century stayed in Baltimore? How much was that a Baltimore thing? How much were they going on to other places in the U.S.?
Well, we're talking about two different eras in the period before the Civil War. Then you really didn't have the railroad network developed, and so more of the immigrants stayed in Baltimore. After the Civil War, there was a pier that was set up in Locust Point, and the B&O ran railroad tracks right out to the pier, and so the passengers could get off the boat, go through inspection, and then take a train west right away, just spending, you know, maybe an hour in Baltimore itself. So in that case, after about 1890, it's about 15% stayed in Baltimore, and the rest went to other locations.
But it would have been a higher proportion of immigrants who stayed in Baltimore before that railroad connection.
Exactly.
And I read that the railroad connection that the B&O actually had an arrangement with the steamer lines.
That's right. The North German Lloyd out of Bremen, or they also Bremerhaven was their port. So the North German Lloyd had an arrangement with the B&O railroad. The B&O built the pier and ran the tracks right up to the pier, and the North German Lloyd agreed to send at least one ship per month with immigrants, and that was increased over time, and it became, you know, sometimes there are as many as four ships in the harbor, or four ships would come every month to unload the immigrants.
So if we're talking about those ships from Bremen, we're talking primarily about German and Austrian immigrants?
Okay, now first it would be German immigrants of, say, the 1870s, 1880s. It was largely German immigrants. After 1890, at that point, Germany is well developed in its industrialization, and so German immigration falls off to Baltimore and generally. But at that point, the railroad networks in Europe extend into Eastern Europe. So the immigrants after 1890 tend to be more Czechs, Poles, Jews from Eastern Europe, Lithuanians. So that would be the group. They would travel to Bremen and then take the North German Lloyd ships to Baltimore.
That is Nick Fessenden here on Midday on WYPR. And his wife, Brigitta, is with us also. They are the driving force behind a new immigrant museum that is opening in Baltimore a week from Sunday. And also with us is Joanne Best, a congregate from the Locust Point Community Church, which has a history of involvement with this immigrant house that is being turned into a museum. You're welcome to be part of this conversation. Did any of your ancestors arrive in this country via the port of Baltimore? Do you have any artifacts from that period? If so, they'd probably be particularly interested in hearing from you. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I don't know who to direct this to, but I'd be very interested in getting a sense of who, let's take that early period before the Civil War, who were these immigrants? Is there a way of describing the kind of people who were picking up and coming?
So before the Civil War, the largest group were Germans, and they really came from across the entire social spectrum. So you had laborers, you had craftsmen, you had professionals, you had businessmen, and again, that was the largest group that came in. And then the second largest group before the Civil War came from Ireland. Some of them were destitute, I mean, because of the Irish potato famine of the 1840s. But if they got here and survived, some of them did reasonably well, because at that point the U.S. was undergoing a railroad boom. You had the B&O Railroad, and a lot of Irish found work on the B&O Railroad, or they worked in industry or on the docks. And so as the U.S. prospered in the 1840s and 1850s, many of the Irish were able to establish a modest middle-class status. So those were the two major groups that came into the city before the Civil War.
And so is it, obviously, we're talking overall about an estimated 1.2 million immigrants from Europe. Wait, you're pointing at me as if that's an oversimplification. Nick, how should we phrase that?
So if we look at the total period, 1830 to 1914, it's 1.5 million. But the period after the Civil War from 1868 to 1914, that part is 1.2 million.
Okay. So we're talking something over a million. So the point I was making is just, I realize anything I ask is asking for a generalization and oversimplification. But who can speak to me about what kind of help some of these arrivees needed from the church? What was the church doing for these people when they arrived? Joanne?
Well, the church was providing basically spiritual help, and that's what the German government, when they gave a stipend towards the immigrant house, they wanted just the church to be there, because there were a lot of changes and people needed that assistance. So both of my grandparents came over around 1900. My grandmother was very instrumental in getting the immigrant house opened, although she never stayed there, and it was just a support system for people that came over. They had a communal area where they would prepare meals, and just lots of newspapers where people were trying to find jobs. And the minister that was in charge, that was a big part of his responsibility, was helping people to get settled and find homes and get jobs.
The church itself had been established
in 1887.
So immigrants were already coming when I mean, that was pretty...
Yes, my grandmother was a member of the church already.
And I'm guessing that was part of how the church saw its mission from the beginning.
Yes.
was in aiding. We're going to take a quick break here. We've got some people who want to be part of this conversation, and I welcome you to be part of it also. If you have an immigrant story to share with us, if you think Baltimore's immigration history has been overlooked and you'd like to add to it, send us an email at midday@wypr.org or give us a call at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Kast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking about Baltimore's not very well known role as a gateway for immigrants. And here with us are three people who have worked to develop the new Baltimore Immigration Museum: Joanne Best and Brigitte and Nick Fessenden. Brigitte and Nick Fessenden are historic preservation consultants. Brigitte is president of the Baltimore Immigration Memorial Incorporated. And you can be part of this conversation. Do you have questions about how immigrants came to Baltimore? Do you wish you knew more about your own ancestors' arrival? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Gary has called us from Reisterstown. Gary, welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you. Enjoy the show. I had been doing some genealogy research earlier and found that my grandfather had originally come to Newport News, Virginia, and apparently came up to Baltimore. He, in turn, saved up money to have my late father, who was born in 1905, with his mother. In 1909, they went to the port of Bremen, Germany, and came from Russia to Germany and then to the port of Baltimore. And I actually got the citizenship papers and showing that they came off the boat. It was the SS Maine, which I think later was blown up in Cuba at the start of World War One.
Ah, yeah, remember the Maine. And so did they stay in Baltimore?
Yes, and actually had papers. We were living in West Baltimore, and my father, up until his death in 94, we've been in Baltimore since.
Hmm. I appreciate your calling. What goes through your mind when you hear his story, when you hear Gary's story?
Well, this is Brigitte. It's similar to many stories we have heard, and we'd love to hear more. And at some point, we would like our museum and the Immigrant House to be a center for information exchange, historic lectures on these very personal histories sometimes, which, you know, give a human face to the history of immigration into Baltimore. And our museum, this is one of the main reasons we would like to have this museum, to facilitate such conversations and ongoing discussions.
And tell me, you said at some point, so tell us what the museum will be like as when it opens, what the near term, what people will see soon, okay, as well as what you hope to add.
Actually, the museum is phase two in our ongoing efforts. Phase one was the establishment of the Baltimore Immigration Memorial Garden, also called Liberty Garden, at Water's Edge on Hull Street.
That's in Locust Point, where Hull Street mm-hmm. meets the water.
Yes. And so we had this established 10 years ago. Now we have the museum. The museum experience will be basically very educational. There's panels describing the histories of each of the eight major ethnic groups that came to Baltimore, with you know, the usual graphic designs and so forth. And we have some artifacts. We are still now in the process of looking for more artifacts from interested people.
I'm going to ask you about the artifacts in a minute. I think people want to hear about them. But Nick, you looked as if you wanted to jump in at some point. Is there a point you wanted to make?
Right. Well, I think this story, I think, is not unusual in that the father came first and then other family members came later after the father had been able to save the money for the passage of the other family member. So very often that was that was quite normal for one person to go ahead and then to send for the others when they had enough money to do so.
And Joanne, let me ask you whether in that case, was that the kind of family that was not likely to use the boarding house as a staging point? If you already had family somewhere, I presume it was more likely that you'd arrive and connect pretty quickly with your family.
We don't have a lot of those records. We do know that there were families who would use the boarding house, and they would all be in one room. But primarily, my understanding is it was mostly the gentlemen who came over first, and then they would probably make arrangements for a home once the rest of the family came over.
That is Joanne Best, a congregant from Locust Point Community Church. Its predecessor church in that location ran a guest house for newly arrived immigrants during the heyday of immigration in Baltimore, the guest house that is now becoming a museum. Joanne is secretary of the Baltimore Immigration Memorial Incorporated. And here on Midday, we also have Brigitte Fessenden and Nick Fessenden. Brigitte, the president of the Baltimore Immigration Memorial, and Nick, its treasurer. How did you get involved, all of you? Let me start with you, Joanne. How did you get involved in this?
Well, it was actually the perfect marriage because a few years ago, we were hoping to restore the Immigration House. Locust Point, for a long time, was a secret in Baltimore, and a lot of the people who lived in that community wanted to keep it that way. And we really wanted to share what we had. We thought we had a wonderful piece of Baltimore's history. And so we had met Brigitte and we had met Nick and wanted to first protect the Immigrant House. And so we were instructed on how to make it a local historical designated property. And we did that, and that's when I learned of their efforts and started to attend the meetings. And at that time, they were hoping to create the museum on the waterfront where currently Under Armour is located. And when that fell through, I offered up the Immigrant House because it's really the real deal. It's where the immigrants came in and they actually stayed there. So that's how we met up initially.
I'm going to ask you that same question, but let's first talk to David, who's calling us from Baltimore. David, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. Henrietta Zold, S-Z-O-L-D, who taught Russian immigrants for about 40 years at the famous Russian school on Baltimore Street, there was a memorial to her, and I noticed it when I moved to Baltimore in 1982. The memorial has disappeared, and there's a basketball court there. Who do you recommend I get in touch with about getting this memorial put back?
Interesting question, David. Let me see whether any of my panelists have an insight. David is not asking you what happened to the memorial. He's saying, how can I sleuth this out? Do you have any suggestions for David?
I'm thinking. I mean, one place might be the Commission for Historical and Architectural Preservation. Having the records
which
of
is,
all the monuments, it's located in the planning department, Baltimore City, and there is, of course, an inventory database of all the Baltimore City. Now, this is city-owned monuments, of course. I don't know if
this
the
was Zold a city monument
was monument. A city-owned monument or not, but maybe Nick has more to say.
The Jewish Museum of Maryland, which is on Lloyd Street, might have the information on that.
Okay, David, those are two suggestions. I wish you would keep in touch with me through Midday if you get an answer. I don't remember ever seeing this this memorial, but it sounds like an interesting story.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you for calling, David. As you heard, we're taking calls here at 410-662-8780. If you are interested in immigrant history in Baltimore, give us a call or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Tell us your immigration story. Are you a recent immigrant to Baltimore? What was your first impression? I said I would ask you, the Fessendens, how you got involved. Brigitte, you have an immigrant history of your own.
Yeah, well, I'm coming from actually almost three perspectives here. I was working as a historic preservation planner for Baltimore City, the CHAP, and I also am immigrant myself, and I care very much for historic buildings. And when the landmark designation for the immigrant house was proposed to CHAP about 10 years ago, I believe, I became very excited, and I thought, what a wonderful thing that is, you know. That also, once that has been done, our organization also worked hard and orchestrated the designation of Locust Point as a National Historic District, exactly for the same reason, for the history and the immigration history, as well as Locust Point history in general.
And so a national designation means what? What would I, as a tourist to that part of town, what would I notice about that?
And that would be the significance of the history as having a major influence on American history, in context to American history, not just local, of course. National designation really gives the honor as a national significant building or district.
Lima, I think I'm pronouncing that right, is calling us from Owings Mills with kind of a key question, I think. Lima, welcome to Midday.
Hello?
Hello, Lima. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My name is Lima with a B. My question is, are you just concentrating on the immigration about, you know, turn of century and maybe Second World War or any immigration wave that came to the United States?
Nick, would you like to answer that question? Thank you for the question, Bima.
We're looking at the at this point, we're looking mainly at the immigration between 1830 and 1914, because that's the importance of Locus Point and the immigrant house. But we also have panels on African-American migration into Baltimore in the 20th century. And then we also have panels on immigration since 1965, when the immigration laws were liberalized. Then we have large numbers of people from Asia and large numbers of Hispanics who've come to the U.S. So we're trying to cover, two centuries of immigration.
That's a tall order. How do you do all that? And how do you? Do you pick some aspects to emphasize?
What we have now are two rooms, and so we have those stories on panels in those two rooms. But what we hope to do is to expand our exhibit onto the second floor, and then which has about 10 rooms or so, and then we would hope to have. We hope to have each immigrant group being able to have a room where they could tell their story. We'd have information on their story.
And the rooms on the second floor, those were the bedrooms. That's where...
They were the bedrooms. And what we hope to accomplish is to have each room, as Nick said, dedicated to a certain ethnic group. But we want their story told. So we welcome pictures and documents and different stories so that we can highlight that group. But in the end, what we hope to do as well is to have some modern day immigrants, and that will sort of bring the museum full circle, where we'll interview some people that have just come over legally and just compare their challenges with those challenges that these immigrants faced at the turn of the century to keep it alive and, you know.
Sure. Michael is raising a question. Michael's calling us from Baltimore. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Your question?
Yes, I've lived in Baltimore about 30 years now, and the largest single group, ethnic group that I've come across have been the Greeks, and I was just wondering if there was, you hadn't mentioned them yet, I was wondering if there was something different about their immigration pattern or time, or if they just were similar to other groups that you've already mentioned.
Michael, I appreciate your raising that. What about the Greeks, Nick?
The Greeks were the sort of the latest group that came in just before World War I. There was not really a distinct neighborhood where Greeks lived, but there is Greek Town, which is where there's a fair number of Greek restaurants and that sort of thing. That's on Eastern Avenue, but it was hard to say that there was an identifiable neighborhood where a majority of the people were from Greece or were of Greek background. They are an important group, and actually we do have a portion of one of the panels that's dedicated to the Greeks. We have a nice picture of the Greek cathedral in the Mount Vernon neighborhood. So it's definitely an important group.
And was there a particular period when there would have been a surge in Greek immigration?
It would be really in the years just before World War I that they came here.
Late in the 19th century.
Early 20th century. Yeah, and then there was some migration after World War I, but not very much.
We got an email from Margaret. Who says, listening to your program, wondering if one could check one's German immigrants' arrival list there. I guess they're meaning at your museum. Our family wonders if our German ancestors came to Baltimore, then got on a train to St. Louis, where they settled. Are immigrant arrival records available there at Immigrant House?
Not at this point. We are working on that. The city archives might have some of these documents. We have yet to mine this source. So I would say stay posted.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
John Best, is there a chance that is the kind of information that went missing in the 60s?
Much of that information is unfortunately what went missing. We do have our original records room, and we hope to create a research room out of that. So what we've talked about is giving people a reason to always come back. You know, they go to a museum once, we want them to come back. And so we would like to provide some of the software where they can research their own genealogy, as well as digitize whatever we have at the house. So they will be able to have a place to go.
That might be relevant to Anne, who's calling us from Glen Burnie. Anne, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. That was really my question. I have been told that my great-grandfather immigrated from Ireland in about 1850. I've always suspected that he came to Baltimore because he ended up working for the B&O Railroad, and I can find him in Illinois working for the railroad B&O in 1870. So I was wondering if there are sources of places in Baltimore where I could try to research if he really did land in Baltimore in 1850. Thank you.
Anne, I appreciate the call. What more can you tell Anne? Everyone's looking at everybody else around the table, and I think they feel like this is something that the museum will be getting to at some point, but not in the near term.
Maybe one comment. It's probably easier to find departure data for the Irish as well as for the Germans. I know the German Auswandererhaus Museum, that's the immigrant museum in Bremerhaven, has a database that lists the Auswanderer, meaning the immigrants coming.
The immigrants people were leaving.
Mostly New York. They don't have Baltimore, unfortunately, as of yet. Have done research on Baltimore, so that's all in the works.
Do you have any impression, anyone here, as to whether, I'm thinking of the conditions in which so many Irish left during the famine, was Ireland keeping records of emigrants, of Irish leaving? Do we have any idea?
I would not know for sure. I would assume they do, but I'm not sure.
And do you know what part of Ireland your grandfather came
from? Yes, I do, actually. I do. King's County, Offaly, which is in the south-central part of Ireland. That's where his family was.
Well, I think you should nurture the question, because I get the sense of energy and intention to come up with the tools that can answer questions like that. But you may have to keep asking it for a while. And I appreciate your calling. Thank you. We're going to take another quick break here and talk more about the new Baltimore Immigration Museum that's starting up, and take your calls. If you have a family story that you would like to share, or if you have in mind an artifact that you think would be good for this museum, give us a call. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the history of immigration to Baltimore. I'm speaking with three people behind a new museum in Locust Point, the Baltimore Immigration Museum. Joanne Best grew up playing in the halls of the old building that will house the museum, and she's been instrumental in finding it a home there. Brigitte and Nick Fessenden have worked for years as volunteers and are finally set to open their museum on May 8th. That's a week from Sunday. You can join this conversation. You can tell us your immigrant story or make a suggestion about an artifact that you think would fit into this new museum by sending us an email at midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. We got an email an email address that's not a name that I recognize, saying, a branch of my family were German Catholic immigrants who arrived in Elk County, Pennsylvania, around 1845. They were farmers and illiterate, per census records. My understanding is that they were sponsored by or assisted by the German Catholic community in Baltimore. Although I looked for them on passenger manifests to the Port of Baltimore around that time, I never found them. Are there any records about this period of time that would explain how this process of sponsorship worked, or who may have assisted them? Do you have any suggestions for this emailer as to how they, how he or she can check out their German Catholic ancestors' arrival?
Well, there were various organizations. There was a German Society of Maryland. There was the Archdiocese. I know the Catholic groups sponsored and did sponsorships. But again, we do not have records of these sponsorships or any lists. That is all to be explored and to be looked into.
Yeah. I read this emailer is looking for suggested avenues. Whether you think, state archives or what you think would be a good place to.
Speaking of the state archives, yes. Nick has some additional information.
So there are ship lists of passengers in the Maryland State Archives. So if you happen to know the name of the ship, or if you have a year, then you could take a look and see if. If the name comes up.
We had a caller who wants to know the name and address of the museum. The address is 1308 Beeson Street, right? Phone number, though? They want a phone number, and I don't have that.
At this point, it will be 443-542-2263.
443-542-2263. We will put that on our website as well as the address, 1308 Beeson Street in Locust Point. Jim emailed us to say, I was always under the impression that my Irish ancestors entered Baltimore through Fells Point around 1870. Does this sound right to you?
It's certainly possible, but the main ships after the Civil War came into Locust Point.
Locust Point, not Fells Point.
Right. Now, before the Civil War, most of the ships came into Fells Point, and then the immigration shifted over to Locust Point after the Civil War.
Was that just a question of the size of the ships?
Yeah, that was
the
size of the
ship.
Yeah, that was the size of the ship. I mean, after the Civil War, the ships were steamships, and some of them would carry as many as 1,000 passengers. The water around Locust Point is deeper and could accommodate the larger ships.
Joe has called us from Baltimore. Joe, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm with the Genealogical Publishing Company, which is based here in Baltimore, and we publish many books of compiled records, passenger lists, and so forth. But there is a book in our list that might help callers who are just getting into looking for their immigrant ancestors. It's called American Passenger Arrival Records by Michael Tepper. And it explains what records exist, when they were officially kept for the first time, for all the major ports anyway. It also identifies other ports. And I learned many years ago, people can find out about it at our website, genealogical.com. Many years ago when I was working on my doctorate in American history, I read a master's thesis by a professor named Kathleen Condon, which dealt with the tobacco trade between Baltimore and Germany. And what she discovered was that many of those tobacco vessels that left Baltimore brought back immigrants because they would have been empty otherwise on their return passage.
So the cargo was tobacco on the way over to Europe and immigrants coming to America
exactly.
On the return trip.
Particularly in the 1830s. I don't know how long it persisted, but that was certainly the case in the 1830s.
So, Joe, you mentioned that your website, genealogical.com, but I want to make sure I'm straight on this book. It sounds to me as if you were describing this book, American Passenger Arrival Records, not as lists of individual passengers, but information about what kinds of lists exist and how to get to them?
That is correct. We have published lists of passengers. For instance, we have a large seven-volume series called The Famine Immigrants, which is a collection of records of all the Irish who came into New York during the potato famine. But for Germans, well, our books tend to be a little bit more hit and miss. We don't have a series, but a company named Scholarly Resources published a large series on Germans to America during, I guess before Ellis Island, so the Castle Garden era of New York German immigration, and that series is available at a number of large public libraries.
Joe, you sound pretty knowledgeable about this. If someone goes to genealogical.com, can they lob a question at you?
Sure. Just send, they can email it to, info@genealogical.com, and it'll get to me.
Okay. I appreciate your calling. We also got an email from Bob, who raises, we've been talking about print resources or words on paper. He raises this question. Have you ever seen the collection of immigrant photos once owned by the Peel Museum, now owned by the Maryland Historical Society? Are these photos something that play into what you're trying to do?
Yes, and we actually are using some of those photos in our panels.
Huh.
Together with a text. Yes.
Okay. Before the time gets away from us, and there's at least one more caller I intend to take, John. I'm not forgetting you, but I do. You raised, Brigitte, some of the artifacts, but I didn't give you a chance to actually describe what the museum has at this point, as well as the kinds of things you're looking for.
Well, we have the original safe, and that was in the house when the immigrants would actually stay there. Probably give their money and valuables in using that. And then we have a trunk with the actual Bremerhaven Baltimore name stamped on it. That's a historic piece. And we have various small items, such as articles immigrants would bring with them.
Like what?
Such as in pillows, linen, maybe a candlestick or two, children's books. So we have those things in the exhibit.
That's interesting. Yeah. Speaking of children's books, Mary has written us to ask, are you aware of the series of children's books written by Esther Bender in Western Maryland called the Lemon Tree series? The first book is called Katie and the Lemon Tree. It tells the story of a young immigrant couple who arrive in Baltimore Harbor and eventually go to Western Maryland to homestead. A dockhand gives Katie a lemon, something she had never seen before, and the story goes on from there. So I don't know, are any parts of your exhibit planned, or do you hope to have something aimed at kids in particular?
I hope we could. That's a wonderful idea, of course. And again, depending on space, we would love to have a bookstore where people can buy, related literature and also, of course, read, have a little library set up.
Joanne.
And on the second floor, we hope to make it very interactive for children so that they can perhaps go through some steamer trunks and see what it was that an immigrant might have brought over if that's the only amount of space that you have to bring valuables over. So we hope to really have a lot of children there.
Yeah, when you described the steamer trunk a minute ago, Brigitte, I think I made an assumption about how big it was. How big? We're all stretching our arms here. We're talking what? Maybe something that would have been three foot long.
3 by 2?
Five the most, 5 feet by 3 or so.
Five would be big and heavy.
And about 3 tall. That was probably one of the larger, items.
John from Baltimore, I promised I would take your call. You want to add something about the Greek immigrants.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello, John. You're on the air.
Yeah. I've been in Baltimore like 35 years, and when we first came to Baltimore, Broadway, it was all Greek. Fellows Point, it was most of the business, their signs were in Greek. It was nightclubs, it was restaurants, the market. I mean, Priebus's was there till 2 years ago.
And, John, are you Greek
yourself?
But you didn't grow up in Baltimore. You came here.
No, we arrived in upstate New York.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we certainly weren't trying to say, in fact, Nick was quite clear in saying that Greeks were an important community of immigrants. Thank you for calling us, John. We got an email from David who wants us to know that many of the genealogical questions can be answered at the Baltimore County Genealogical Society. Many of the ship passenger records are available online at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And I'm getting...
Yes, of course. Yes.
Yes, of course.
People have to go there directly. They can go through us as well, so...
And in terms of the, Joanne, you mentioned hoping at some point that this museum will have a room where people can do research. Would they be able to access that kind of national resource?
That's what we're hoping to do, have partnerships with perhaps Ancestry.com and the local societies, as we've just mentioned.
Okay. So as you're starting this museum in less than a week, I imagine it's kind of crazy. It looks very calm from the outside, but I haven't been inside. What are your pipe dream hopes? What would you most like this museum to have, say, in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years? Somebody needs to answer. Somebody must have a vision.
We all have dreams. That's for sure.
I'll start with just... One of the things that this is a dream right now, but we were offered, there was a beautiful bar and it's gone back and forth, so it doesn't look like we will have that. But there was a handcrafted bar from Hungary that we were hoping to put in the basement and have a revival of some ethnic nights where if it was the Polish night, we would have Polish food and we would have Polish music and Polish dance. And, you know, maybe one of our dreams was once a month to have an ethnic evening. And in Locust Point, there were Nick did a lot of this research, but there were blocks where there was the Italians and blocks where there were the Polish, and they played soccer against each other. And there's still a lot of the ancestors that are there that are holding on to pictures that we would love to get a copy of.
Ah, yeah. If you've got pictures, share them. Brigitte, you're
yeah.
What kind of dream would you share?
The dreams. Well, I think more like a goal than a dream is to make people understand that immigration, it is an ongoing process. Things change, as we just heard from a Greek person. You know, neighborhoods change. Immigration keeps going, and new people come to Baltimore. Also, just to establish the knowledge about Baltimore's importance in this immigration history, and also not just for Baltimoreans, but for the heritage tourism aspect, and have people come to Baltimore for that reason, in addition to many other reasons, of course, to come to Baltimore.
Well, I really appreciate your giving us a preview of the museum that's opening at 1308 Beeson Street on May 8th, and I wish you luck with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brigitte and Nick Fessenden, who on May 8th will open the doors to their new museum, the Baltimore Immigration Museum. And thank you to Joanne Best, a member of Locust Point Community Church, whose predecessor ran a boarding house for immigrants during the heyday of immigration in Baltimore and has made the building available for the museum. Also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in Monday. Crime novelist Laura Lippman has built a legion of fans with twisty mysteries set mostly in Baltimore. Lippman has set her 20th novel to be published in a few days in Columbia, Maryland, where she went to high school. I'm Sheila Cass. Be part of that conversation with Laura Lippman on Monday. And meanwhile, have a great weekend.